If food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat meat. Paul's argument is, just don't make a stumbling block to the gospel.
Don't divide over food.
It's simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
We are so like sheep. We are kind of stupid. On this edition of The White Horse Inn, we're discussing idolatry and other bad habits. The White Horse Inn. Know what you believe and why you believe it.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn, where we are taking a look at what it means to be Christians in a post-Christian culture. That's our theme for the year, and before we get into our own time and place, we're trying to look at the wisdom of the Apostle Paul as he addressed Christians in a pre-Christian culture in his first epistle to the Corinthians. Idolatry, the word seems remote to most of us. How many times have you seen somebody bowing down to Baal or pinching incense to Caesar and the Roman gods? Of course, we know that there's still idolatry around. We've at least seen pictures of people in other religions engaging in the worship of idols. But still, it's hard for us to see the immediate relevance of Paul's warnings against idolatry in 1 Corinthians 8. Besides, we don't even really use the term idolatry anymore because we're supposed to respect not only the rites, but the religions themselves that other people hold. But idolatry is simply the substitution of anyone or anything for the triune God who has met us in Christ through the gospel. Just think today of the daily liturgy of Wall Street, opened by ministers of the market from lofty perch to the ringing of a bell. No one needs to be reminded these days of what a crummy God the market makes. But today, many churches take their cues more from the demands of the market than from those of the world's risen and ascended King. It's easy to place our ultimate confidence in technology, especially in medicine. Our piety may teach us that we belong in both body and soul and in life and in death to our faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. But in daily practice, it's a lot easier to believe our lives really belong to the state, or to the market, or to medicine. The malls are packed on Sunday, but a lot of packed churches share its assumption that the customer is king. Lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying its power. That's how Paul defined the state of things in these last days. In 1 Corinthians 8, Paul addresses the particular problem about participation in idol feasts. Not unlike the Masonic Lodge or other secret societies that used to be de rigueur for anyone in town who wanted to get ahead, civic life in Corinth was inextricably bound up with the imperial cult of Rome. You weren't a real patriot, and therefore a reliable employee or upwardly mobile entrepreneur, if you didn't participate in these secret rituals and tip your hat to the pagan gods. Not much was required. You didn't have to throw your firstborn into a volcano, just a few gestures that proved you were a team player. Well, this is why it's so crucial to know what you believe and why you believe it. If you're immature, as the Corinthian believers were, it's tough to know when you're coloring outside the lines. If you lack distinct convictions, you'll surrender them without even knowing it. Here, as usual, Paul finds the heart of the answer to idolatry in the gospel. We can learn a lot from Paul's apostolic wisdom here in this passage, and so we're going to do that with Rod Rosenblatt, professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine and a Lutheran minister, Kim Riddlebarger, pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California, Ken Jones, pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California, and I'm Mike Hart, and I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. Gentlemen, first of all, what's the problem here? Now, concerning food offered to idols, that sounds like something completely non-applicable to our situations that we face today.
I think the solution is in verse 4. This is where we can kind of tie this to our own day and age. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and there's no God but one. So you have a case here of people who are sacrificing to things they think are idols. So in this case, it is the vain human imagination that takes a thing God has made, has appointed for its place and purpose, and assigns to that some religious significance that means something to the individual but doesn't create demons or idols or other such things in reality. So for them, because they think this thing has occult powers, Paul says there is no reality to an idol, but if somebody approaches a statue, a carving, and presents food to it, then for that person, that idol is real.
Because Satan and demons are real.
Exactly.
Well,
when this is probably one of those areas where a blurring of the two kingdoms really became an issue at Corinth, because the practice that Paul is addressing here is not Christians going into a temple dedicated to an idol, but rather the cultural or the social holdover overflow as it relates to social guilds or banquets in a public facility. And there were remnants of the paganism in the surrounding culture that were part of those banquets or those meetings.
That and the fact you could go, you know, you didn't have a butcher shop in Corinth. Yeah. There was no refrigeration. So when something was slaughtered, you better eat it, you know, pretty quick. And so some of the meat would be sold to the banqueting hall where the guild...
Whatever was left over from the sacrifice.
Yeah, so whatever's left over, the butcher shop would sell to make a profit. And the question
is... It was the temple butcher shop.
Yeah, can Christians actually eat this stuff? And the Jews, of course, were a little bit nervous because it wasn't kosher, but Gentile Christians had to really wrestle with that.
And then also, a lot of times, your guild dinners, your civic dinners and so forth, would be held in the temple banqueting hall.
Right.
And so
with bad things going on during the meal.
Well, and if you went to the health spa, you know, there were certain things, not just sexual immorality, but there were, you had to, as you walk in, pinch your incense to Caesar or the god Asclepius, whatever the patron was of that town. Everything was tied up together. You didn't have to really do much in terms of obeisance. Not much was required for this civil religion. You could still go on being a Christian, presumably, and you wouldn't be persecuted necessarily. It was the claim that Christ alone is Lord, even over Caesar. The imperial cult is actually idolatry, and no Christian can participate in it in any way, shape, or form. That made Christians look like they didn't really love the empire. They weren't really...
They weren't good citizens.
Good patriots and citizens.
Well, and that distinction that you just made about participating in the rituals or the services. That's why we make that distinction that it seems that what Paul is addressing here is not the direct participation in idolatrous or pagan worship, but those things that were present in the culture that were just sort of on the fringes, that were that stemmed from the idolatrous influence of the surrounding culture.
Now, it seems like based on what little evidence we have from what Paul says in the way of response, that some Corinthians had said that because an idol has no real existence, anyone who even eats food from the temple is an idolater. So anyone, as you say, Kim, who goes to the temple butcher shop to buy meat is an idolater. Others, no doubt, found it hard to give up their pagan attachment to the gods and the outside chance that they might become angry for abandoning them. So, you know, not going to miss it by a technicality. Let's keep the gods happy in case there are some. Still others, and verses 1 and 4 seem to show this, claimed superior knowledge which allowed them to participate even in the temple dinners, not just buy the food from the market, but participate in these cultic ceremonies that were also civic. Because, you know, our souls aren't being polluted by participating in that because the idols don't really exist. For Paul, however, it seems like it's the context, not the food, that matters.
Especially
in chapter 10, where he explicitly says, hey, here's the temple dinner over here, which is idolatrous. Don't do it. And then on the other hand, simply eating meat sold in the marketplace. If you participate in the temple dinner, you're uniting yourself to demons. But if you're just eating meat that has been sacrificed to idols, it actually belongs to the only God who lives. The only God who lives gave it to you, and it's our triune God.
It's like going to Costco in the first century, and you get a good deal on it. It's cheap. It's good. Why not?
Yeah. Well, and to their credit, the Corinthians, it seems as if from Paul's words in chapter 7, verse 1, that they had some concerns about these things, and they were trying to think through these practices in light of their position in Christ. And that is to their credit. They wanted to make, even though some took either extreme, they took some wrong positions maybe or some extreme positions, but it seems as if they were trying to reason through their Christian faith how they are now to interact with this part of the culture.
It's interesting that Paul wasn't superstitious. You could imagine him saying, well, just don't even touch meat that has been offered to an idol. Why would you eat meat offered to an idol? That just is horrible. Don't even think about it. But he really thinks, look, idols don't really exist.
Yeah.
The gods that they represent don't exist. This is God's meat. God created the beast who gave up the meat that you're eating.
Yeah.
It's from the hand of God, which for a Jew is an amazing thing to say.
Yeah.
Is it stretching too much to say that there is an application to public prayers or other religious actions in a civic context today?
Well, I don't know if you can make that here. I do think what we do have from Paul in this passage is a real strong warning to be careful to avoid anything that is tied directly to idolatry. Things are not just innocuous and innocent all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want to go to the Masonic Lodge. And you wouldn't want to go to the Druid temple. There would be some places here that we wouldn't go based on the comments Paul makes here.
What about pastors saying okie dokie to praying civic prayers but being told, don't mention Jesus Christ?
Well, in our synod, you can get in trouble doing some of that. Some have. We don't look very kindly on a kind of a generalized religious exercise done, say, for example, maybe in Yankee Stadium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a civil religion in America. If we think this is off the chart where we are today, it's even more dangerous, kind of, because we think it's Christian.
The one that gives me the creeps here is the religious service in the National Cathedral after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And the president's in the pulpit, which right away creeps me out.
In a pulpit of a church called the National Cathedral.
First of all, presidents have no business being in a pulpit any place. The second thing that creeps me out is the fact there is a clergy person from every conceivable religion found in North America, and they're all together in the National Cathedral participating in the same service. Mm-hmm. We have to be really careful of this. This is not just a...
With onward Christian soldiers playing in the background.
Hymn of the Republic.
Yeah, Battle Hymn of the Republic.
But if the question is whether or not a minister should, say, for instance, give the invocation of a city council meeting, that'll probably come down to the conscience of the individual.
I agree.
I reached a point where I could not in good conscience do it for a number of reasons. But I do think it's up to the individual conscience and your understanding of the role of the church and, you know, in such civic affairs.
Mike's original question was, can a minister pray in a situation like that when they're forbidden from using the name of Jesus? I would say, thank you, no thanks, I'm not interested. I have asked at occasions like that if instead of having an invocation, may I offer a prayer for the community?
Huh.
Praying for my community as a representative of that community, and they didn't like that.
Interesting.
Mm. Wow.
They want God to be a mascot and cut the
ribbons.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Paul says in verses 7 through 13 of chapter 8, however, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol. Your point, Kim. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. This is very similar to Paul's argument in Romans 14, where he says, if to you what you're doing is dishonorable to God, then it is. You're violating your conscience.
Mm-hmm. Can't do it.
Can't do it. And so wait until your conscience is taught on these matters. Don't ever go against your conscience. And isn't that something important for us to remember? A lot of times, we're like big brothers with little brothers. When someone has just gotten all excited about the doctrines of grace, whatever you want to call it, Reformation theology, and we just can't wait to introduce them to the world of Christian liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And if we act before they've been taught what the implications of the gospel are for Christian liberty, we can actually get them to wound their conscience.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they don't believe that it's right yet, for instance, to go out for a beer, don't be an idiot and take them out for a beer.
Right.
Sure.
Let them mature, and maybe, given their own background and whatever, they won't want to have a beer.
Right. And Christian liberty is
they have liberty to do it, to
liberty,
not have a beer.
Not have right. a beer if they don't want to, sure.
Well, right. and that kind of irresponsible approach is what Paul addresses both in his letter to the Corinthians as well as Romans 14, but especially in Romans 14. He talks about those who have the knowledge that there is no danger associated with this. Well, at the same time, you have a responsibility to your brother. So now, if you abstain, it's not because you don't have the knowledge that an idol is nothing. But if you abstain, maybe you're doing so for the benefit of a weaker brother. Yeah. As,
which be a
as,
very
as
good
addresses.
Reason to
yes,
abstain.
Absolutely.
And this would be a good time to hear Calvin's counsel from those who would tyrannize the whole congregation by being weaker.
Yeah. Calvin has a great passage in the Institutes where he says, on Christian liberty, where after saying Christian liberty has to be discussed here after justification because it is an appendage to justification, he says, it is not a slight matter, as people are telling us. If people don't experience Christian liberty, then it doesn't matter how much they assent to the doctrine of justification. They're not going to really get it. He says they will in their actual Christian life be wondering whether they can step on a crack and break their mother's back, whether if I can handle water, why do I need wine? If I can drink cheap wine, why do I need more expensive wine? If I can have these clothes, why can't I just have a hair shirt like the monk and so forth? And it just, he says, the mind gets entangled. The conscience becomes entangled in a mess. He says, we need this for the gospel. And he says, here's what you do about the weaker brother argument. He says, if you are causing someone to sin against their conscience, that is the weaker brother. You are the stronger brother sinning against that weaker brother. But he says, ask the person who uses the argument, what about your weaker brethren? Ask that person if he or she is a weaker brother. And of course, they don't think that they're weaker. They think they're stronger because they abstain. And he says, so let me just say this. For our weaker brethren, we surrender our liberty. For the Pharisee, never.
Wow.
Yes.
So see here, this is the difference. Paul's talking about the weaker brother, and he says, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. It's just sanity.
It's just wisdom.
Yes.
Common sense.
Good grief. Why did you have to just anger everybody there so that they can't hear what you have to say about the gospel now because you had to flaunt your liberty and make a point?
But don't you guys have a sort of a calculus the way we do? Give it about 18 months.
We call it the cage phase.
Really?
Yeah. There's a name for it.
Really?
Yeah.
A new Calvinist is like an ex-smoker. You want to just kind of lock them up for about 6 months so they like, calm down a little bit.
Really?
But, you know, it sounds like Corinth.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is Corinth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Here, they thought they had superior knowledge. They divided the church into those in the know and the lower class. They had divided everything into socioeconomic classes, the wealthy and the poor. We'll talk about that later. And they had divided the church along the lines of those who have liberty to do anything and everything and those who don't. Those who brag about not disciplining an unrepentant person and the others. Church was being torn apart by immaturity.
Yeah, and that does illustrate the immaturity that Paul addresses in chapter 3 when he says, you think you are mature, but aren't you really babes? If you're squabbling over whose camp you're in, if you're, these are an issue, aren't you really a babe?
Yeah, he's sarcastic throughout this epistle. It's funny to see some of the quotations. There are lines that he takes, like all things are lawful. We just often think, well, you know, Paul created that line. No, he was actually quoting them. All things are lawful, yes, but not all things are profitable.
Yeah.
And it's just like Luther figured out like a week and a half after he started proclaiming justification, antinomians popped out of every window.
Yeah.
And Luther had to say, no, it doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
Paul goes on to say, we are no worse off if we do not eat, no better off if we do, but take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus sinning against your own brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. Now, again, Pharisees will take that and say, well, then you should never indulge your liberty, whatever it is, where the taboos are concerned, if it's possible that a weaker brother or sister might see you doing that. That's not Paul's argument. Paul's argument is, you guys don't get it. The answer, gospel. What's your question? Gospel. The gospel, the gospel, the gospel,
right,
and again
on.
The gospel.
Yep.
It's amazing how this is his answer to everything.
Yes.
Just don't make a stumbling block to the gospel.
Don't divide over food.
It's simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
We are so like sheep. We are kind of stupid. We are kind of stupid.
When Aunt Martha passes the roast hog knuckles at the church potluck, and you have scruples about roast hog knuckles,
say, no, thank you.
Yeah. And our inclination to stuff like this and our non-inclination to the gospel.
Right.
I mean, our interests betray us. We'll talk for whole evenings on issues like this.
Yes.
It's like when Jesus...
Then you have a Bible study, and you're going to study the New Testament words concerning what the cross accomplishes, and four people out of 600 show up for that.
Yeah. Right.
But if like the religious leaders, you ask Jesus his spiritual policy on IRS matters, everybody's listening. Everybody's all ears.
Well, I would have been.
Ooh, Jesus is
I would have been listening for that one. You'd use another
you
illustration.
You didn't like what he said, do you?
Spoken by our son of thunder.
Yeah.
it's so hard to hear the tax collectors come off better than the pastors.
Rod, that's a textual variant. That's not in the best.
Oh, really? Really?
I've concluded.
He says, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Then he goes on to say, this is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? So evidently, Jesus' brothers, including James and Peter, had wives now, and they were on the road with their husbands.
Mm-hmm. And cared for by the church.
Cared for by the church. That is his point.
Yep.
Here I am, a tent maker. Let's talk about rights.
Yeah. Hmm.
You ungrateful people. You want to talk about rights? Let's talk about it. Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, he says, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. There it is again.
It's amazing how he's able to argue both sides of this issue, or to first off delineate the real issues here. I can't imagine the Corinthians in their letter to him were able to articulate the problem the way Paul addresses it. But he sees to the heart of it. This is not just a matter of whether or not Christians have a right to eat meat. Mm-hmm. He looks at this from the side of the person who sees no problem with the meat, as well as from the person who really has a conscience issue with it. And he addresses both sides very thoroughly, and he anchors both responses in Christ.
That's what I find, again, so odd. I think if you took any practical issue like this that was dividing the church, think of all sorts of parallels to this in the church today. You go into a Christian bookstore, get a book on this ethical problem or that ethical problem, how to solve this dilemma, what do you do when ...
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet it would be tough to find the gospel in any of those books. The gospel is assumed, but now you're asking a practical question.
Right.
I'm going to give you a practical answer. It just blows me over how for Paul, everything... I mean, aren't you being simplistic, Paul? Aren't you being reductionistic?
Right.
Everything goes back to the gospel?
Right.
Wait, let's settle this issue. And Paul says, no, this is decided on the basis of whether it puts a roadblock in the path of the gospel. The gospel really is the jewel It's the treasure hidden in the field.
Yep.
This is it. This is worth living and dying for.
And he's very explicit in telling them, look, if you, because of your knowledge, think that it's okay to hinder a weaker brother, then you're sinning against Christ.
Yes, you are. Yeah.
I mean, it's just point blank. So that person now, they would have to shelve some of their prepackaged arguments in defense of their excessive use of their liberty at the expense of their brother. Now they have to go back and look at their relationship to one another in the body through the lens of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Let me raise a question here. What about good counsel in light of the gospel to those who are always going around as brothers, shutting down other people's liberty in some way or another, because we've got a boodle of them who do that?
Well, then I would say, here again, back to the issue we discussed in the last program of church discipline, only elders can discipline. You can't have the sheep running around
disciplining other sheep?
Wild, wild west.
Okay.
The shepherds are the ones entrusted with the sheep and the care for the sheep. But also, it's not about rights, it's about responsibilities. When I made a profession of faith and joined a church, I made a promise. I made a pledge. And I said, I will submit, just as the texts tell me to, if I'm a Christian, submit to those who have authority over you, for they will give an account. I made a promise to do that, to submit to them in their admonitions, in their teaching, if necessary, in their discipline regarding doctrine or life. And that means that I can't then, when I actually need to be called on the carpet, invoke my rights as an American.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When I have pledged my responsibilities to the church.
Great. Now, will the elders help me out with the guy who's always hammering on me?
They better.
If it's one of ours, I'd hope
I'm
so.
I'm thinking of the guy who's on the other side.
I hear you, Rod. That's the perception of the weaker brother. The weaker brother seems to be the loudest brother in the evangelical ranks.
His vocal cords aren't weak.
But yeah, exactly. But I think the answer to that is Paul's statement in Romans 14. I think he says, then let us no more pass judgment on one another. And mm-hmm. and there he's bringing to conclusion his argument about responsibility, exercising responsibility in our liberty, whether we choose to eat or not eat, drink or not drink. In either case, what we have to guard against is making a judgment on the other person because of their understanding of Christian liberty.
Good use of scripture.
Yep.
That's why that question from Calvin's really helpful. Is this person a weaker brother?
Right. Right. Of course.
Yeah, and we hear from, and I think what you're talking about, Rod, we hear from evangelical ranks, well, you shouldn't go into a liquor store because you never know who's watching, or you shouldn't go into a bar because you never know who's watching.
It's Calvin. And there's no end to
this.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. And because who knows? There may be a weaker brother. Well, who does know?
Right.
And that's not what Paul is addressing.
Right.
He's not addressing that's not the appearance of evil. That's what he's addressing here, both in Romans 14 and here in 1 Corinthians, are those whose conscience are not strong enough.
Right. Yeah,
whose understanding of the gospel is not strong enough to deal with these disputed issues because they are fresh out of paganism.
Yep. Agreed.
Go ahead.
The stronger believer is not the one who drinks and eats the meat sacrificed to idols.
No.
The stronger believer is the one who might but has decided not to, or who has decided to. In other words, the believer who thinks, I'm free, but in my prudence, I'm deciding to either forego it or indulge it.
Right. Yeah.
That's a strong believer.
That's a strong position.
But the weak believer is the one who says, I think it's wrong for everybody. I think it's wrong to eat meat that has been sacrificed to idols. I think it's wrong to drink alcohol and so forth.
Two things in response to this, just on a real practical note. One is the strong need to elevate the weak to the level of strength. The goal here is not to let the weak destroy Christian liberty for everyone. The goal is for the strong to raise them up. And the second thing is the strong have to dig in their heels a bit when the weak demand that the liberty of an institution be changed because some one of them is offended. Mm-hmm. Let me give you just a concrete case. For example, in our church, we use wine in communion. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, what if someone's an alcoholic? Well, the strong make a concession to a person who either doesn't like the taste of wine or has scruples or somebody who just may not care for it. We'll put a ring of grape juice in the center. Uh-huh. The strong make provision for the weak, but the mm-hmm. weak are not going to take the wine away from the strong.
Right. I heard an even better answer. The Altar Guild would put in a drop of wine into a glass of water.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah. Mm. One of the places where it comes through so clearly, Paul's personality and character, is where he goes back and forth between boasting and not boasting. You know, you can tell sometimes he really wants to boast. He wants to sort of let it out, that he's kind of proud of his ministry. And then he realizes what the ministry is proclaiming. And he says, I can't be proud in myself. Here's what he says. I'm not asking for you to give me my rights. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting.
Hmm.
For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting.
Yeah, his boast there, though, is as a proud father.
Yes.
It's not as though he thinks he's better. It's that he's really proud of what the gospel's done. Yeah. He takes pride in watching God work. He's a vehicle, a means.
What will be my boast on that day?
Hmm. Yeah.
Will it not be you?
Yeah, in fact, in 1 Corinthians or in 2 Corinthians, when they require a letter for him, he says, you are my letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then later in chapter 11, he uses the language of a father. He says, I thought I'd be able to present you as a chaste bride, mm-hmm. you know, as a father would present a chaste bride to the groom. And that's how he sees his relationship with the Corinthian church. So like you said, Kim, his boasting is in his confidence of the effect of the gospel.
Yeah. I don't know. I think he is understandably responding to the fact that of all of the apostles, he's been treated like dirt in terms of how people have taken care of him. And they have the temerity to talk about rights. If you want to talk, do you want to open this can of worms? Let's talk about rights.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'm not asking you for my rights because I want to boast about this. I would rather have this boast.
Well, certainly in that is.
Than have my rights. But then he says, nope, you can't even do that.
Yeah.
Because the gospel takes that away. Yeah. What is my ministry about? It's not only not about rights or money. It's not even about my right to boast.
Yeah.
No, in that context, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, because he's saying that he has personally allowed himself to be deprived, consciously allowed himself to be deprived of those things that would be the right for someone in his office.
And I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting, he says.
Wow.
But for if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel.
Yeah.
I mean, what I love about that is even when you're going down a track that isn't gospel-centered, for Paul, the gospel always brings it back.
It comes back.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing that he says, woe to me if I preach not the gospel?
Yeah.
And that's not, whoa, I don't know what I'd do if I didn't preach the gospel, is it?
No.
It's a little stronger than
no, yeah.
Necessity is laid upon me.
And sometimes you wonder, with the middle-aged and older clergy like me, where did it go? Mm-hmm. You know, you think, I'm not sure that's characterizing me anymore. Hmm. Woe to me if I preach not the gospel. But it sure characterized Paul.
Yeah. Woe means curse.
To
a Jew.
Yeah.
Covenant curse.
It's a covenant
curse.
Sure. May I go to hell
if
I don't preach the gospel, is what he's saying. Is this really the thing that drives most of the practical advice and practical wisdom in our churches today?
No, but it should be.
I certainly hope it would be. Even for those who misunderstand what the gospel is, because I hold that out because if they misunderstand and they encounter what it actually is, it might reinvigorate them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We get letters like that.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Right. And we always, that's why we're not judges. We are saying, that the same woe falls on us as ministers if we don't preach the gospel.
But I took your question. I mean, what is this the diet people are getting?
Yeah.
And no, because I think what people are getting is the practical tips to this, that, or the other instead of the gospel.
What the Greeks like.
Yeah. I think we're in an age when many, many churches are giving people the wisdom and the rhetoric and the charismatic impressiveness of some of these speakers that Paul was talking about, the super apostles. They're on television, they're everywhere, and people are getting that. They're getting their best life now, not the cross. And because they're getting something other than the cross, all of these questions, this list of should I do this and should I do that, that becomes an issue again because people don't have the clarity that Paul had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I certainly pray that we would have more pastors that would hear this, you know, over and over again. I'm with you, Rod. When we get those letters from pastors that they have been their desire to preach the gospel, their purpose has been, it's been revisioned in a sense. It's been refueled because of what they've heard from us. I think that's helpful. That's what it's about. It's the gospel that brings salvation to the lost, and it's the gospel that strengthens and sustains those who have been brought in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In verses 19 through 23, finally, he says, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them." Isn't this where Luther got his idea in the freedom of the Christian, that the believer is the
sovereign lord of all.
Sovereign lord of all.
And subject to none. And then secondly, subject to everybody.
And lord of none.
And lord of none.
That's basically what Paul is saying here. Though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all. We're free for the first time to love and serve each other instead of lord it over, precisely because we have been liberated from
superstition and idolatry.
and condemnation of the law.
Yes.
Yeah.
To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. This isn't rocket science, Paul is saying. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law.
Yep. Mm.
Timothy and Titus come to mind.
You want to talk about Christian liberty. The Christian liberty is not a person having a beer at a Wesleyan convention. Christian liberty is not having a beer at a Wesleyan convention and trying to talk to those people about what justification means and refusing to have a beer the whole weekend.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's what Paul's talking about here. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law.
Gentiles.
To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings.
You know, Richard Longenecker says that is the defining verse for Paul.
Well, I agree. I think if you were to run to Paul at Home Depot, you know, and he handed you his business card, it would say, "The Apostle Paul, Church Planner." Yeah. And that's his whole purpose statement right there.
All for the sake of the gospel.
All for the sake of the gospel.
But the verse before it has been quoted probably more frequently than any line from Paul in the last 20 years. I have become all things to all people. And by the way, that's usually elided. So there's, I have become all things to all people, period. But Paul says, I have become all things to all people that by all means I might save some. I do all for the sake of the gospel. What does Paul mean here? I have become all things to all people. Is he a chameleon? Is he basically saying, I'll do rock music for people who like rock?
No. He's saying, I will step into your moccasins. I will walk in your moccasins, and from there we'll go to Christ and his cross.
Yeah. Mm. Given the context in the New Testament, what this is getting at is when I'm with Gentiles who do not have the law, I will preach the gospel to them, and I will eat the stuff that's served to me. I'm not going to divide over what's put in front of me, the food and the drink. They ask me, the hospitality they extend to me. I will take it to preach Christ to them. When I'm with Jews, We see this in later in the book of Acts when Paul goes back to the temple. He purchases the doves and does all the rest of it.
And he's not going to demand a ham sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to be very careful about offending people's scruples to avoid missing the offense of the cross, to avoid preaching Christ. So his point is, look, if I'm going to preach the gospel to people, I'm going to be very, very careful not to put obstacles in the way of that gospel. And so I'm going to eat what's put in front of me. I'm going to be gracious and quiet, and I'm not going to pit Jew against Gentile on cultural stuff.
Yep. I remember talking to a pastor a long time ago about some really serious problems that I was hearing in his preaching about justification. And he said, well, it all depends on the context and who I'm speaking to. If I'm in a group that is more antinomian, that is lax with regard to the law, I sound like a legalist. If I'm in an audience that is more legalistic, I sound like an antinomian. And I thought how different that is from Paul, who was neither a legalist nor an antinomian, precisely because for him, what he was willing to be a chameleon on were issues that this pastor wasn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Where Paul was willing to be a chameleon was on whether you have wine with your meal out in public.
Right.
Whether you eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. This particular pastor wasn't willing to give on issues like that, but he was willing to give on the message that was being preached. Paul said it's absolutely the opposite. The gospel doesn't change. I preach the same gospel regardless of where I am. But in order to get to preach that gospel and to actually, if your goal is to win people, not to flaunt your liberty, but to win people to that message, to that gospel, then you have to give up. You don't have rights in this matter. Yeah, it's not about rights. It's about the gospel.
Yeah, it's not about rights.
Yeah.
Well, in the same way, as you indicated, some people misused this verse, misused this verse to support different types of worship. Claiming to be all things for all people. But Paul, again, is not addressing a worship service. He's not saying turn the worship service Gothic in order to appeal to Gothics. Mm-hmm. But rather, how about not being offended when you are in a public place and there is a person who has piercings and tattoos and, you know, drive a Harley. Let's not get offended at loud music. Mm-hmm. Sit down and listen to some of the loud music if you want to make a connection with people, again, outside of the church. His point is, I'm not overly offended by things that people do according to their customs or traditions, whether they're religious or otherwise.
Yep, exactly right.
It's not going to hinder me from finding a road to share the gospel.
But if you participate in liturgical services, worship, that involves eating meat sacrificed to idols.
Right.
Can't do it.
Right.
That is sharing tables with idols.
Can't do it.
And the application to us is, all things to all people does not mean, cannot mean, you can do whatever you want in worship.
Exactly.
Right.
That's
exactly
the point. Yeah.
Right.
It means you can eat whatever meat you want from the market.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it means is distinguish the two kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Is that fair?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's exactly right.
Folks, there's one place where Paul just once again shows how the gospel's relevant for everything. He doesn't just say, in answer to every question that comes up, Christ crucified like a parrot.
Hmm.
He does apply the gospel. He does unpack it in different ways, responding to different problems. But it is amazing how it's the same gospel that applies to all of these issues. We must not think that ours is the first generation to think that we just need the right technology, the glitzy marketing, the powerful, persuasive, motivational speakers, the charlatans who come through town selling their wares. We mustn't think this is the first time that ever happened. We need to realize that we're living in a post-Christian culture that isn't all that different from the pre-Christian culture that Paul found himself in Corinth. And so next time we're going to pick up where we left off, turning to Paul's discussion of the Lord's Supper and how the Lord's table needs to be celebrated in a pre-Christian culture. Look forward to being with you again next time on the White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.